This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
We're getting a sense of who this fellow is that we're talking about today and where he's come from. And from now on, we're adopting a sort of faceted approach, one by one, I think, not forensically, but in the spirit of friends. We'll be turning our attention to various aspects of Bob's contribution. And we'd like to begin this panel, which will be looking mainly at Bob's impact in the field of archaeology, anthropology and museums generally, and museum management, with Dick Kimber, who is well known to many of you, I'm sure, as an historian and long-time resident of Alice Springs, who spent decades travelling with senior Pinterby and Walpree men. And he met Bob Edwards during the early years of the painting movement, when the Western Desert painting movement, and did a lot to ensure that a representative collection of this material was available for museums and major collections. But of course, Dick, first encounter with Bob was in the museum in South Australia. Over to you, Dick.
Thank you very much, Philip, and welcome to everyone here. And very nice to hear Dick Richards. We were in the surf club together, and I can remember sitting up on top of the hill with a lightning storm around us, Dick, a long time ago. Very nice to hear those comments about Bob's background too, and it was a lovely area. It had a CWA and almond blossom tours, as I remember when I first got there. But going back to Bob, though, I met him first in 1965, as I recall, through old Mr. Cooper. Everyone called him Mr. Cooper, but Harold Cooper was his name. He's a wonderful old bachelor who I think he decided he was going to get married once, and then someone said he wouldn't be able to do his survey work around the hills and or do his sailing around the coast, and he decided he'd better stick being a single bloke. But whatever the case, he was a wonderful old character, and he taught me about stone tools, and it was through that he introduced me to Bob up in the South Australian Museum. And Bob, I think he's probably learning a control process over a random sort of a kennel like I was, because I'd started to collect stone tools all over the place, which was then a reasonably done thing. It might not have been... It isn't now, but it was at that time. And old Harold had taught me you have to put the place name on it in Indian ink, and you have to put the date of it and things like this, and you put it on the side you aren't going to display if it's going into a museum. And I'm sure old Harold learnt that through both Norman Tyndale and Bob to do that sort of a thing. However, whatever the case... Bob said, look, we're flat, stony, motherless, broke in the museum pretty well, pretty much the same now, I suppose. But what you have is that he said, can you help out a bit if we get a call in? So the first call that they got was a farmer down at Meningi, and he said he'd found a skeleton eroding from the sand on his farm, and Bob said, could you go down there and do a little report on it? So I did that, and I did my best to do a little sketch of the remnants there. They were very fragmented. And Bob said, can you make that little report? So I did, and then Bob put a South Australian Museum note on it and wrote to the farmer and said, dear sir, thank you very much for your interest. We appreciate that. And then can you put a few star pickets and a bit of wire around it or something to protect the skeleton? I think it was what you had was Bob was encouraging the public to become interested in Aboriginal cultural world. And so you had Harold Cooper and myself, and Harold was called an on-ethnographer. I think Bob had invented the term, but it was gave you a sort of a sense of being worthwhile to the museum. And old Harold was in his 80s then, and he'd be sorting all the stone artefacts in the museum, had a big old handwriting and a wonderful old character. But then after I'd done a few more trips, Bob made me an on-ethnographer, so I was very proud to be associated with the museum in that way, but also with old Harold Cooper. And furthermore, there was Darby Jambinjimber. Now, Darby was an old or middle-aged wealthy man at that time who came down to the museum. I think he'd been down for health problems initially, but he went along and Bob gave him a dust jacket. And he worked there in the... I remember Bob got him to get some Spinifex gum to fix something there, which allowed Bob to get a record of the mending technique, as I recall. But also, Darby was that pleased with that jacket. It gave him a sense of being there. So I'll digress a bit to a football game. Darby loved this jacket, and he became a football umpire out at Yuendumu. He'd only ever played Aboriginal football, so he didn't understand the rules that well, but he loved being the goal umpire, so he'd be down there in the white dust jacket. And there was this tight game. It was a grand final in the Yuendumu sports weekend. Yuendumu must win in these sorts of situations. And the ball came bouncing, went over the tops of the fullback and the full forward and bounced through to the goals, and Darby was looking at it like this, and he got the flags ready, and it bounced over the line, and it bounced out again. So he sort of stopped. He thought, what on earth do I do now, sort of thing. This is, so he didn't wave the flags, and the fullback had been racing back in despair. He just kicked it in anger, really, because he'd seen it go over the line. Went up the field, and there's only one umpire been umpiring all weekend. He was umpiring from the middle of the ground, and he waved play on because Darby had... So the wrong team won. So at that stage, the umpire, there was a man called David Odling Smee who had a very English voice, and he said, "We will not resort to spears today," and knowing that they had spears all around the oval. And you had the entire Yuendumu footy team was chasing Shane Wolfe, his name was, off the field, and Shane was running for his life. He'd run all weekend umpiring, and he managed to get in the car, and I said, "Just sit there calmly, don't show you're scared." He was terrified. And in the end, I remember talking with old Darby about the reason for this decision, where he said, "Well, that football, he's got a law. That law to football, well, he bounced this way and then he bounced that way. That's the law to football." So that was an excuse for Darby, and everyone agreed that he was right, more or less. And then after I was really impressed with Bob came back. I remember him talking about Ingilady and the work with John Mulvaney, where he got eventually dated engravings. And I think Bob's suggestion, my memory is that he said something like, "John said, oh, he might be interested," and threw it up on the bench on the side. It might have been a slight exaggeration, but whatever the case, he was highly impressed with that. And then the Cleland Hills, I was highly envious of Bob having gone out there, and I lucky myself to get there first with a camel team, and with one of the camels dying on the way, and a mate of mine was out there, and he marauded to the ground like he's a normal Western hero. But it's really, I think what I'm saying, though, is partly Bob gave me introductions to vast numbers of ideas that I could follow up on, and these included meeting, say, Jimmy Jungerai, who was a key figure in one of the films and is a lot of images. The image I can see here of the Cleland Hills was a fabulous one to go and see. So those sorts of experiences are good, wonderful for me. However, when I got to the Alice, Bob said, "Look, can you..." I said, "Look, there's fabulous lots of artefacts up here, Bob, still for sale everywhere in the what they called the boomerang shops, with the tourist shops." And so he said, "Look, if you can see any good stuff and it's well documented, can you send it down?" And I'd send him a telegram and say, "Look, there's some good stuff here." He said, "Look, if there's any..." And I said, "There's some fabulous..." Well, not fabulous, but unusual fakes here. He said, "Send them down too, because we need the curators to know about the fakes." So I must say, most of the things I bought were very good quality, which the South Australian Museum could have, or Bob could give to another museum overseas or interstate. But I'll just list a few of the artefacts. I'll just keep them in my head, really. There was one was a fake boomerang design, because there's a white bloke in town was buying boomerangs and put an Aboriginal design on it, that would double the price when he sold it again. So I sent that down. Then there was one was another white bloke used to get the kangaroo bones when he was working on an Aboriginal community. He'd chew up a bit of toffee and put it on the end and sell it as a pointing bone. So I said, sent them down. I said, you better be careful with the toffee, Bob, I think, because you might get ants or something. And there's another one where a bloke had picked up a bit of stone from the side of the road, got a stick, split it, and he put a bit of bitumen around and said, here we are, we've got a stone axe. So I was sending down these, and the last one I'll mention was a back of an old mirror, like a very white, pearly white-looking mirror, and an Aboriginal bloke got it, and he burnt a little pattern on it and sold it as a pearl shell. So Bob managed to get all these items sent down as well as some hot, top quality stuff. I know we're going to run out of time, but I'll just finish with one more if I may. My memory is this might, Jenny Isaacs might correct me on this, but I was walking around the streets with Bob and he nominated a particular house in the main street to be purchased for the Aboriginal arts and crafts industry to raise the prices there. That was purchased and a bloke called Roy Monks, who's a very nice bloke, got to work with a sledgehammer and made it into a sort of an art centre. Then Roy had to go buying things and Bob had said, look, we want to lift the price, we want to lift the interest, we want to make sure you get quality stuff. So Roy went down to Indalkina and he said to the old blokes there, look, I'll buy every spear you can make in a week. And he came back and then I travelled down with him the next weekend and Roy went into this little tin shed and he staggered out backwards like a cartoon character and he said, he couldn't stop laughing. He said, have a look in there, Dick. And I went in, and there were 500 spears. And every Tacoma vine in the country had been cut down, and Roy had promised $5 each. So you saw these fellas, which were the going price for a spear then was $1. So Roy had to pay up, and these fellas all grinning like Cheshire cats. But then Bob had to deal with that, and there many, many other issues like that he dealt with. I think four car rollovers at one stage, Bob. And I'll finish with this last one on the car. The last car rollover, I remember, was an assistant who had never driven before. And he went out to Papunya and he rolled the car on his first little night excursion up at a T-junction. I raced out with another good mate and we saw the car and mainly checked out if he was all right. So I wrote to Bob and said, look, Bob, dear Bob, sorry, the car's rolled over again. Everything's all right, though. This assistant is okay. But I didn't know the assistant was also riding one. Said, dear Bob, I'm sorry I rolled the car. I'd had a few beers. I'd never driven before. I was as high as a kite. And I'm sorry I pranged the car. So I understand Bob actually got a bit angry at that time. But good memories to have. And thank you for the times, Bob, and everyone else here.
Thank you. That was classic Dick Kimber. And now we'll just move on to Nick Peterson very briefly, Professor of Anthropology at the ANU, long experience in Central Australia, particularly around Yuendumu with Walpiri people. And this is where he met Bob first in the late 1960s. Over to you, Nick.
I'm going to talk about something that actually didn't happen, but if it had happened, it would have been damaging to both our careers and take them off the rails, possibly. I met Bob through photography. I was employed by the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies, as it then was, as the ethnographer for their ethnographic film unit. And our remit was to go out and film men's secret restricted ceremonies because the Institute believed, rightly in a way, that they were disappearing and not being held as frequently as they were, and they wanted a record of these ceremonies. And we got to know about these ceremonies in various ways, and in 1966, Draper Campbell, who was an important patron of Bob's, approached the Institute to film two men's increase ceremonies at Yuendamu. And as a bit of a greenhorn in outback Australia, and I'd never been to Yuendamu before, I arrived there a few weeks before the film unit to find out a bit about, beyond what I'd read about Walbury culture. Anyway, we filmed two of these men's ceremonies and made, they were wonderful films, it was a very different period, and I want to pick up on something that Philip said, and that is that this period of transition was a little bit earlier than I think than Philip realizes, because in 1966, and this may seem a bit appalling and the rest of it, the care that anthropologists and others were taking about secret sacred material was very different from what it was today. Remote Australia was very remote. None of the Aboriginal people who lived in remote communities ever came south, or very, very rarely indeed. All this, of course, changed once Whitlam got in, and then that barrier was breached completely, and many Aboriginal people from remote Australia regularly were seen in settled Australia. So there was always the feeling that these films that we made could be used for teaching. We were sort of aware that they shouldn't be on television, and we reassured Aboriginal people they wouldn't be on television or shown in schools, which is what I was instructed to say on behalf of the Institute of Aboriginal Studies, but they could be shown in universities, and the people were aware that there were women at the universities as well as men. Anyway, it was in that climate that Bob was making a wonderful photographic record of both these ceremonies. I first got Bob into trouble, actually, because during the 2 weeks I'd been there, I was asked by Aboriginal people to buy a whole lot of sacred boards, not for myself, but for the Institute of Aboriginal Studies. And so I did that, and I gave half of them to Bob for the South Australian Museum. And when he got back to the South Australian Museum, the Northern Territory wrote a very fierce letter and said to him, "You've exported these objects without a permit." So he bundled them up and sent them back to Alice Springs. Within a couple of weeks, they came back with a stamp of approval from the Northern Territory. But that was a really minor thing. Bob's photographs, as we all know, are absolutely wonderful. And so we decided that we'd write a booklet, not a major booklet, but to go with the film on Rougarie, the Emu Cave. And it was a very spectacular ceremony and a very with a wonderful painting. And I think, and Bob can correct me, but I think this was the early beginning of Bob's sort of understanding that many of these heritage sites that he was seeing as an archaeologist, in fact, were part of a living religion. And he was just getting to grips with that at that period. Anyway, fortunately, both of us were reasonably inefficient at writing this article. And although we started in 1966, it was only 1969 that we got it completed, you know. And that was our saving, because early in 1969, Richard Gould published a book, which some of you may know, Yiwara, I think his name is. And that caused a huge problem, because a schoolgirl from Warburton Mission went to Perth and saw her aunt on the cover, just a portrait of her, and so opened the book and looked through the book, and there are a whole lot of secret sacred photographs in there. And this had a crisis effect, because Western Australia then closed the Western Australia to any anthropological or archaeological research. And John Mulvaney, who may talk about this, called a very important meeting about access to the field. And subsequently, which laid the foundation for a sort of much more ethically aware research behavior and the whole basis for working around the secret and the sacred in Aboriginal Australia. And Bob was asked to draw up some of the first guidelines for the Institute about the restricted materials and how to deal with them. So if we had been more diligent and if we had got the book off the ground, we'd have been in trouble like Dick Gould, because in a way Dick Gould never managed to do, did suffer. He never managed to do field work in Australia again, and he went off and worked elsewhere. Subsequently, I visited Bob on a number of occasions. In the past, when you flew from Canberra to the Northern Territory, you could get off at anywhere you liked without extra cost, and you could switch between TAA and ANZET without any trouble. And so I often stayed with Bob and Kath and experienced their wonderful hospitality, the house full of books. I was interested in books as well. And I learned a few things about buying multiple copies, 5 copies of Friendly Mission, if I remember correctly, Bob. And Bob always had lots of copies of many books. And he was very generous to us younger field workers at that stage, because the South Australian Museum was stopped from blowing away by any storms by the weight of off-prints that it had of all its articles in the basement. And those articles still exist, actually. They've all been shipped out to a book dealer in Beulah Park, and his shop is still anchored down by a huge, wonderful stock of off-prints. And if you're interested, you should go and visit him. So, and through that, Bob... also, one other thing, he was very generous around photography. He had a wonderful technician who developed and printed his photographs, and I used to send all my black and white negatives down there and get them done at the very highest quality and wonderful blow-ups, one of which any of you who have been to my office will have seen is hanging on the wall. So thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much. Well, staying in Central Australia, really, we'll turn to Mike Smith, who's a pioneering desert archaeologist who has done a lot of work in the centre, in the arid zone, and but began also his work in South Australia on the Lower Murray, where Norman Tyndale had pioneered archaeology at the South Australian Museum in 1929. Mike, in Central Australia, was inspired by Bob Edwards's discovery, really, of a rock shelter with archaeological potential at the Cleland Hills. And I believe Mike will be speaking a little bit about that. Thanks.
Thanks. Well, yes, I confess I'm a South Australian, and I think Adelaide people have generally looked north to the desert for adventure and inspiration and opportunity. I think a person's life is really can be like an archaeological site, and you can see this with Bob's life. In the top layer, the rich layer, you've got the AEA remains, rich food remains, exotic trade goods. Deeper down, you've got museums and cultural institutions, and somewhere around the middle of the sequence, you have a layer of Bob as archaeologist. And this is my Bob, and this is the layer I want to talk about and make 3 brief passes over it. Now, I first met Bob as a schoolboy archaeologist at the South Australian Museum in, I think, 1970, 1971. But I want to jump forward to the early 1980s. Imagine me, I'm a government field archaeologist based in Alice Springs. I'm doing what I think is the first archaeological survey of the region. I'm working out gradually further and further away from town, looking for stratified sequences, somewhere where I can find a build-up of deposit that will represent a sort of an archive of Aboriginal occupation in the region. Now, I'm based in the residency. Some of you might know, in the centre of Alice Springs in Parsons Street. I was in the residency by myself. I just had a 4-wheel drive vehicle, not much else. And in the drawer, there were some enigmatic, what looked like site cards. No background information, just an extract from some reports. And one spoke of a large cave near Mount Winter in the Cleland Hills, 200 feet long and 60 feet high, which shows signs of human occupation going back over great periods of time. I had to find this site. Where was it? There were no clues on the site card, really, as to what I was looking at. It could have been an old institute site card. It looked like perhaps it was an extract from a newspaper article. There was a cryptic reference to Edwards. I wrote to Bob, but he was busy and I didn't get a reply. I didn't know where the site was, except somewhere near Mount Winter. I knew Bob had been out into the Cleland Hills, of which Mount Winter is part of, to look at a famous engraving site at the northern end of the range. I spoke to my literature mates at Haast Bluff. They half knew of the site but couldn't give me a name. Without a name, I couldn't get a land council permit. It was very difficult to do open sort of free range survey work out that far west, 350 kilometres west of Alice. But eventually I got out there with Dick, as it turned out, and we knew the rock shelter had to be somewhere on this escarpment, and Dick walked one way and I walked the other way, looking at shadows, trying to make them into overhangs, looking at the ground, looking for stone artefacts that might give us a clue to a focal point for Aboriginal use, walking up the creek lines, looking for rock holes. And eventually there it was, at Purujarra, the very big rock shelter you'll see on the screen eventually, a big opera house type, opera shell type rock shelter. Now, I did three seasons of work there. Really, it's the Australian equivalent of one of the great Paleolithic sites of southwestern France, a 35,000-year-old sequence, a rich record of human occupation in the heart of the continent. Eventually, of course, my archival research caught up with my dirt archaeology, and to my surprise, I found that Bob had already dug the site. To see how this came about, you're never the first as a field archaeologist, to see how this came about, we need to do another pass over this archaeological layer. So we go back in time now, we go back to around 1965, 1966. Bob is starting to develop his work on prehistoric rock engravings. It first of all in the Flinders Ranges and in the Aleri region of South Australia, and gradually is extending further north. There was an eccentric character called Michael Terry, a prospector, a very colourful character, wore sidearm, fancied himself a bit. He'd been out to the Cleland Hills quite a lot, and he found some engravings that he thought were the remains of lost civilization, Phoenicians or something non-Aboriginal. He badgered Vincent McGaw, he badgered the Institute of Aboriginal Studies, and eventually Bob was dispatched to sort it out in 1967. So he did this fabulous trip to this engraving site. You'll see the engraved faces on the loop. But that wasn't enough. Bob wanted to institute a much more systematic survey of rock art and archaeological sites in Central Australia. And somewhere along the line, he managed to convince the Australian newspaper to fund it. Another example of his charm and his fundraising abilities. And so in 1969, for 10 weeks, he engaged in this mammoth journey through Central Australia into the Tanami, into the area west of Alice Springs, into the Anangu Pijinjara lands, right across to Blackstone Range, 11,000 kilometres, recording many rock engraving sites and rock art sites that have barely been visited since. It's a journey that had been very difficult to do even today, logistically difficult. He did it in a Land Rover. Anyone who's ever had a Land Rover knows these vehicles have personality problems. Much easier in a Toyota. And on one of these trips, inevitably, the Land Rover broke down, overheated, had fuel problems. The radiator got blocked with Spinifex. And on this trip in the Cleland Hills, he had Timmy Jugadai with him from Haast Bluff. And Timmy went for a walk. He obviously knew of this cave. He found Purujarra. Bob went to have a look, recognised its potential, made very explicit notes about its potential to sort out the prehistory of Central Australia. But, of course, the expedition had to move on. Bob subsequently serialised that trip in a whole series of articles in the Australian. Probably that was the payoff, the quid pro quo for the newspaper. Very interesting reading, very elegant field notes, but no one ever went back to Purujarra. Bob got sucked into work on the rock art in the Alligator Rivers region as part of the Alligator Rivers environmental fact-finding study, the lead-up to the establishment of Kakadu National Park. And most other archaeologists were fully engaged with Lake Mungo and Arnhem Land and Devil's Lair and the Nullarbor Plain. There was really no one to follow up his discovery at Purujarra. And it dropped entirely out of our corporate memory until I independently found it. Now, Bob's, the third pass through this layer, Bob's work on the prehistoric rock engravings is part of a long South Australian tradition. Bazardow in 1904 worked on the engravings. You had C.P. Mountford, and Bob worked with Mountford, amongst other sites, on the famous crocodile engraving at Panoramity. And he extended this work to Central Australia. And I'll just briefly summarise why I think this work is so important. Along the way, he did what was really the first systematic archaeological survey of Central Australia. At this time, 1969, 1967, Mingould was starting to dig at Punta Diapa in 67. Eugene Stockton, a Catholic priest, was digging at Santa Teresa at Corinca Rock Hole in 1969. But Bob's really was the only broad-ranging survey. It was the first quantitative analysis of ancient desert rock engravings, first person to approach it in a way where you count the frequencies of motifs and look at the structure of the art. He promoted the idea that rock engravings and rock paintings were significant field monuments worth preserving. He produced an absolutely invaluable photographic record of the rock art sites of the region. And he also promoted the idea that this was these rock engravings, these very old-looking desert rock engravings, very weathered designs, were part of an ancient pan-continental artistic tradition, perhaps an Ice Age tradition, that had fragmented over time, that somehow the engravings were remnants of an ancient Aboriginal social landscape. Now, we probably wouldn't assess the engravings as quite so old now. I mean, my own work suggests these desert engravings are probably around 8,000 years rather than 20,000 years. But it's a very powerful idea, and it's been very influential in archaeology. And he also, in terms of his own rock art research, he sits squarely between the earlier work of Fred McCarthy and C.P. Mountford and the shift to modern research by Leslie Maynard and Mike Morwood and Andre Rosenfeld and June Ross, who's really been the inheritor of Bob's work in Central Australia, and Joe McDonald. And just to finish off, while Bob initially saw the rock engravings as an ancient art lost to the present, a remnant of a distant prehistoric period, his later championing of the Papunya Chula art movement shows that he wasn't locked into an antiquarian perspective. In a sense, we get a picture of Bob, like many field workers, being transformed by the encounter with the desert and with Aboriginal people in the region.
Thank you very much, Mike. And we're going to shift perspective right now by moving forward a bit into the museum world. And we'll probably end on that note too with John, but we'll begin first with Robin. Robin Hurst from the Museum of Victoria, or Museum Victoria, who has bearing witness, I guess, to Bob's first big museum job as director of the Museum of Victoria over essentially a five-year period. And over to you, Robin.
Thanks, Rob. And at the outset, what a pleasure it is to be here today with this distinguished audience and to pay tribute to you, Bob. My name is Robin Hurst. I'm Director of Collections, Research and Exhibitions with Museum Victoria. I started with the museum in 1981, so I preceded Bob by 3 years. I'm a humble infrared astrophysicist by training, who came to the museum to do an interesting job, and they kept giving me interesting jobs. And Bob was all part of that. But Bob was the first director of the new Museum of Victoria. Now, this is an interesting segment of his life, and it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I'm going to start at the end, come back to the beginning, and finish off with the middle, as modern filmmakers tend to do. And so what I want to do is, this was the last annual report that Bob wrote the director's comments on. And he was talking about the future, because at this stage, and I'll take you back to this, he had secured commitment by the Victorian government to a new institution. So he says the dry and dusty institutions of the past, to which reluctant school children were dutifully marched, have given way to dynamic centres of learning and experience which offer fresh insights into the nature of human society, the delicate balance of ecology, the lives and habitats of insects, birds, mammals and fishes, the wonders of scientific and technological achievement, etc., etc. So this was Bob's vision for Museum Victoria. And to keep the government straight, he then went on to say, the government's far-sighted commitment into the redevelopment of Museum of Victoria will bring us to the forefront of this new era, ensuring that the dedicated groundwork which has been laid will result in the full flowering of one of the great museums of the world. So, Bob, I want to give you a report. In the last financial year, Museum Victoria, the headquarters which you had envisioned back in your time, had over 1 million visitors, all ticketed. We know who they are. And it won the Victorian Tourism Award for the major attraction. Science Works, one of the museums that you envisaged as a multi-campus museum, had over 500,000 visitors and itself was a winner in the tourist attraction category. The Immigration Museum has won so many awards that it's now in the Hall of Fame and it attracted another 123,000 visitors. You'll be pleased to note that 300,000 school children visited those museums. We've hosted major exhibitions recently, Pompeii, Star Wars, Titanic, which has set the new Australian record for visitation, and Tutankhamun opens in April. In terms of research, we're key contributors to all sorts of scientific journals, including Nature and Science. We've got a dozen ARC linkage projects, and we've got 30 PhD students working in the museum. We're exporting our planetarium shows and our technology, and we've won numerous awards from the American Association of Museums related to our exhibitions. So, Bob, the school children are not any more reluctant to be marched through the museum. And we are recognised nationally and internationally for our research and for our public engagement. All I can say, Bob, is I'm sorry it took so long. So let's go back to when Bob started at the museum. In 1983, the Victorian government decided to put two museums together. There was the Natural History Museum of Victoria, the National Museum, and there was the Science Museum, which dealt with technology. They existed under one roof in Swanston Street. And the government, or two governments, in fact, the Liberal government, then the Labor government, thought it was a good idea to combine these two museums. Similar ideas have been floated in Sydney recently, you will recall. Anyway, those two museums had each existed for well over a century, and each had its own culture, deeply, deeply embedded. One was about research and taxonomy. The other one was much more about collecting and public engagement. Both councils were opposed to this amalgamation, and most of the staff, I would say, were not enamoured with the idea at the time. So in rode Bob. Well, he didn't ride in, he strode in, and we had never seen a suit like Bob's in the museum before. He cut a fine figure. But Bob, being a team player, he decided he needed to recruit his executive team. And I'm reminded of John Sturges' famous film, The Magnificent Seven, which you might recall was a remake of The Seven Samurai, where a Mexican village had to go out and recruit this group to help defend it. And there were only five of them, but they were a very interesting bunch of characters you managed to recruit, with Jim Bowler, who is a renowned natural historian, Boyce Pizzi, who came out of Heritage, Andrew Reeves, who's here today, a Labor historian and a great master plotter. And we had John Chessels, and John Chessels' first wife's here today, and I said, well, what did John do before he came to us? And she said, I don't really know. But he came out of Canberra, and he had worked as an advisor. And I remember I sat on the panel with Bob when we recruited him, and Bob said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, look, I think he's worth the risk." He said, "Oh, he's a wild man," and he did prove to be a wild man. But we also had the steady hand of John Zolas, if you remember, who was looking after the finances. So we had this group of really, really interesting and passionate people working with Bob. And I'm not sure whether Anne Watson would be here today, but you might remember Anne, who kept control. She was like the palace guard in a way, and used to protect Bob from unwanted interruptions. But Bob was a master at playing the politics, and he understood that he needed to lift the profile of the museum, and so he got the Meyer Foundation to provide some sort of funding and a report by Arnold Hancock, who was at the time the chair of the State Bank, well-respected figure. And so in November 1986, that came up with the first idea of a multiple-site museum. And included in that were a series of things that Bob had in his sights, one of which was Spotswood, where Science Works is now, and Bob achieved that while he was there. Another one, strangely enough, was the Royal Exhibition Building in Carlton. So there were five in Group 1, and there's another 11 in the remaining group. So we're steadily picking down your list, Bob, adding to the enterprise. But what did Bob do? He raised the profile through this report. He just endlessly talked it up. Bob the Advocate, he had the capacity to tell the same story over and over again, and I was amazed. And he told it with the same passion to everyone that he talked to. He had the endless capacity to write and acknowledge the people that had helped him. He had Kath sitting in the office every Sunday, typing up the letters, getting them out there from the previous week. He had this endless capacity to remain pleasant, even under fire. He also introduced something new to the museum, and that was prawns. Anne Watson used to shuffle off to Victoria Market and bring back things for lunch, because we had no catering or anything in the museum in those days. So Bob used to provide these lunches where he could schmooze the politicians, and where Anne was not only part of the palace guard, but she was actually the caterer as well. So it was an interesting time for us to watch. Bob also brought in the blockbuster, The Gold of the Pharaohs, Civilization, Devil, Drugs and Doctors, and Ancient Macedonia were some of the exhibitions he brought in, because the more he could bring in, then the more chance he had of getting politicians to open them, engage with them, and talk about his vision. So I know a lot about this because my office was right next door to Bob's, so I got to see quite a bit of him. Also, in those days, they had a staff rep on the executive management team, and I happened to be that, so I could see the inner workings of his magnificent five, under Bob's. Bob was clearly the master of that executive management team. But my office was right next to Bob's. It was also at the time of Halley's Comet. I was running the planetarium. We had endless crowds there, which I think were great for Bob, because every time he brought anybody in, they had to make their way through those crowds. And so the popularity of the museum could not be denied. Bob was also an early adopter. He produced the first fax. None of in the museum, because they were very early days. Nobody knew where the other one was, but it seemed to be sending messages to it. So I can remember standing there being amazed at these plans for exhibitions coming off this particular machine. So that's great. So Bob, you did have a vision. You got government commitment, sure. Particular project that you got them to commit to fell over, but another one replaced it, because you had created a momentum that had to be met. Every vacuum then had to be filled. And so we've moved on, and we've built on that, and I'll acknowledge the work of Dr. Patrick Green, current CEO, who over the last few years has done amazing things in the museum. But, Bob, the time that you were at Museum Victoria was absolutely pivotal in the development of the museum. You caused the spark and others have tended the flame. And this flame now illuminates the lives of millions of people each year. So, Bob, I salute you. Museum Victoria salutes you. The museum community salutes you.
Many thanks, Robin. And the last piece of jigsaw to be put into this little pattern that we're developing here is from John Mulvaney. And probably of all the people in the room, John may well be Bob's oldest friend. And in some ways, they've followed each other's careers, one another, even though they've been on some occasions on opposite sides of the world. Complementary projects, particularly relating to heritage, archaeology, and museums. And so I'd like to introduce John Mulvaney, who probably needs no introduction. I think he's just brought out his autobiography in case you need to check anything. Thanks, Bob.
John. Well, I'm delighted to be able to participate here to pay tribute to Bob, who's been a friend and great academic assistant to me, and a schemer too. Very great help in schemes. I think I can claim the oldest contact because young Bob Edwards was brought out to my excavation at Fromm's Landing on the Murray River, and I think it was 1956 was the year. From then on, we've had very close association in many ways. One of them, perhaps Robin left out in his tribute. Bob even got the Queen to his Melbourne Museum. So it wasn't a very successful visit, I felt. But that wasn't Bob's fault. One of the things that also I think I would add to his comments about his work in the South Australian Museum is that during the period when he was a curator, he initiated contact with the elders of Northern South Australian people and negotiated what I suppose we'd call a keeping place in the basement of the museum where these elders had the key to go and inspect their material. I think that was the first attempt in Australia to acknowledge that there were secret, sacred objects of importance to Aboriginal people where they could have the right to see them and the knowledge that other people would not be permitted because they are in this locked area. And Bob's work with influence on me has been very strong. I've been advocating ever since the need for keeping places where Aboriginal people have things in trust but not destroyed, not reburied. However, that's by the way, but Bob has been a very important influence in that. In 1966, Bob was granted or received a grant from the Institute of Aboriginal Studies to do something that I'm sure he, as a South Australian, felt proud to be doing, following in the steps of the explorer Stuart, who's, I'm sure, one of his heroes. He moved from South Australia to the top end of the Northern Territory, photographing rock art sites across the whole territory. And that is a tremendously important archive. And I am indebted to Bob, like so many others in Australia, for the use of his photographs, photographs of that trip, photographs of other times. And unlike the present legalistic system where one has to have copyrights and triplicate certificates for the use of anything, Bob just says, use them, and that's all. You don't, he doesn't receive payment. He gladly allows it. And that's so unlike the present situation that I thought I should emphasise it. I've been the beneficiary, certainly. Bob included in that trip visit to my excavation at the site, which I call Ingoladdy on Willaroo Station, southwest of Catherine. And Bob arrived from the South Australian Museum and joined our party there. And the film we were looking at before of Bob photographing sites, he was photographing the art at that site, but not on that trip, was it? Right? Was it, did you go back there again? No, all right. I didn't know you had a movie camera. Who was taking the movie? Anyway, that's why aren't I in it? So, but the one of the important things Bob brought with him was a big jar of lollies, which were going to be given to Aboriginal children. But Bob and I ate the lot, I think. The other childlike contact took place in 1968 in the summer vacation when Bob's family and my family swapped houses. Bob took over my house here in Canberra, and I think the day after he arrived, the hot water system burst, so his entire time here was without hot water. Meanwhile, we enjoyed his house in Adelaide. But more seriously, Bob came to Canberra as the deputy principal of the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies, as it was then known. And one of the very significant things where we did work together was when the Whitlam government appointed the Hope Inquiry into the National Estate, which seems to be overlooked in cultural studies these days. It was, to my mind, one of the greatest landmarks in Australian cultural history, that the federal government would appoint a committee to look into Aboriginal places, European, post-European places, and the environment, all in one report, unprecedented, the interrelationship between them. Well, I was on the executive of the Aboriginal Institute, and Bob and I were the people who spoke to the Hope Inquiry when they visited the Institute, and I think they spent a whole afternoon with us, and Bob particularly emphasising the significance of Aboriginal places that couldn't be just a dot on a map like a house, that had to be the environments. And I think that was a major step towards trying to get the appreciation of governments that Aboriginal places were more than a cave, for example. Then around the same time, I was appointed on the Alligator Rivers Region Environment Fact-Finding Study, which was a curious title, and it was a curious idea that you could find facts and nothing but the facts. And the facts, of course, were envisaged by people who thought, all right, Aborigines, we must cover them. Right, we must document their sites. We don't need to document their social life or what the impact of mining uranium in the Kakadu Park might have on the society, but we want to know the facts other than the social facts. Bob was in charge of documenting the rock art of the region. Now, others had been documenting it, but on my count, Bob documented 300 Aboriginal sites and produced a report on it, which was subsequently published and was one of the first major studies of the rock art of that region. And subsequently, of course, it was put on the World Heritage List. What else? Well, other people will talk about Bob's work in the development of the Papunya art, the Western Desert. But I do remember that when he was chair of the Aboriginal Arts Board, he was landed with dozens of these marvellous paintings, now worth thousands of dollars. But nobody wanted them and he had to get rid of them. And he was trying to get people to buy them. And I think he is owed a tremendous amount of credit for his efforts, which have paid off tenfold, of course. I know my department at the university acquired a few of these works of art. And I'm running out of... I can't remember, I'm getting too old. My memory's no good. The spin-off from the Hope Inquiry, which reported on the fixed places in Australia, was the Piggott Inquiry on Museums and National Collections, which dealt with the movable objects across Australia. I might say that as a member of the Piggott Inquiry, we found tremendous resistance when we visited some of the states who didn't think the federal government should be representing us at all. It should be interfering. And might I say, the then director of the art gallery in Melbourne, who probably had the richest art collection in Australia at the time, tried to prevent us visiting the place. Anyway, that's by the way, but it was one of the things that alerted me to the needs of conservation in Australia. He told us that they had a conservation lab. It was in the furthest basement. It had a part-time curator, a staff of one part-time, and we knew that the gallery had only opened in 68, that there was a bloom was being, dust was being blown through the air conditioning and was settling on all the paintings. And when our chair asked him about this, he denied it, said there was nothing at all. So we, in the Piggott report, we did stress conservation needs above all others. And I'm pleased to say that art galleries and museums did answer the call, including from the federal government. But on this regard, Bob Edwards had led us to... he knew what the problems were in the South Australian Museum, and we were shown things such as... spears and axes, which had been stored in the top attic of the museum where the heat was so intense that they'd run, so that spearheads and axe heads were the opposite to where they should have been because they just melted and run. Thanks, Bob, for alerting us to all these things. And finally... worth comment. The Piggott Inquiry also took the three-sided view that the Hope Inquiry took, that if there is a national museum, it should emphasise Aboriginal society, post-European society and the environment, and above all, the interrelationship between these. Each one would be equal, and they would be showing the interrelationship. And it was decided that a special committee should be appointed to plan what the Aboriginal side should represent. And I was appointed chairman because I was a member of the Pigott Committee, and Bob Edwards was one of the members of that planning committee, which produced a separate report which is included within the Pigott report, and we made many recommendations, some of which were not followed, and of course subsequently we recommended that the museum should be in the area, in that report we recommended that the museum, the National Museum, should be put on the hilltop where at the moment, last weekend, was opened up to the community to see the forests which were being planted up there. Our concept was that it was a marvellous hill with a view over the lake in Canberra, and members of my committee, the Aboriginal members, said they didn't want their Aboriginal museum to be looking down on European Canberra. So we proposed a design where the Aboriginal side was on the hilltop and it faced out to the Brindabellas, and the post-European museum faced Canberra, and there was lots of scope for the environment, and we wanted outside exhibitions that would try to differentiate between the different cultural groups within Australia. Subsequently, Yarramundi Reach at the end of the lake was decided, and subsequently, of course, the Howard government decided on this site, reducing it from 80 hectares to 19 hectares. And if you had to park this morning, you'll know what the result was. And unfortunately, the design of the museum disregarded the exterior display of Aboriginal society and certainly undervalued the interrelationship between the three divisions. But I just will close by acknowledging the contribution Bob has made to Australian museums in general, to thoughts about conservation, certainly thoughts about Aboriginal people within the landscape. And the fact that a lot of these things haven't come to pass is certainly not Bob's fault. He certainly schemed enough. Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much, and I know that we've covered enough ground there to produce or to make reference to a number of tricky issues that faced Bob as he negotiated his way through all of these fields of interest. And it may well be that some of you have thought of some questions and points and issues and other contributions. And we have 15 minutes, so why don't we throw the floor open and take a few questions either, well, to any of us here on the panel. Ah, yes, Howard.
Is it working? Yeah, I can just make a very brief personal comment because I, like many other people, I would not be here in the position I am if it wasn't for Bob Edwards, because I was writing a master's thesis at University College London in the early 1970s, and I thought I'd written it. I submitted it to my supervisor. Things were different in those days. And he said, this is no good, it's all theoretical, you've got to analyse something. In despair, I went to the Royal Anthropological Institute and I found an ancient copy of the South Australian Museum magazine with an article on towers by Stirling and Waite. And I then wrote to Bob Edwards at the South Australian Museum. I found these objects extremely interesting. And Bob Edwards then, I was a master's student at University College London, organised that photographer Nick was probably talking about, managed to send me 480 colour slides of the towers in the South Australian Museum, together with all the documentation that Reuter had put together, together with photographs of Hillier's map. So in my bedsit in London, I was able then to become totally absorbed in the towers of the Lake Eyre region of Central Australia, thanks entirely to Bob Edwards. And that's exactly the kind of person that Bob has been always, I suspect, in collaborating with people and using the resources at his disposal to help other people in their projects. So I'd like to thank Bob enormously, because my life would have been completely different if it hadn't have been for him there and then.
Well, I'd just like to comment a little bit on some of the things that Robin had to say, because I also worked with Bob at the Museum of Victoria. He was my first director. And I just wanted to, elaborate a little bit on something that Robin touched on briefly, and that is the famous Edwards charm. Bob was my first director, and he set the bar very, very high. But Bob not only charmed politicians, and I do remember the Queen's visit, but he charmed his staff as well. And that's an incredible plus for a director to be able to do, because it means that your staff will work for you and do what you want because they want to do it. And I think that was one of the major pluses that Bob brought to his directorship at the Museum of Victoria.
I'm Hank Eaves from Melbourne, and I'd just like to make public the fact that I got thrown out of the Museum of Melbourne for spraying one of the printing presses with DDT because it had woodworm in it. And the handle that makes the platen go down actually made it go up. It wasn't really put together all that well. So twice I was evicted from the museum because the then current director didn't think it was terribly important. About a couple of weeks later, when I was running my print shop, this gentleman walked in and said, "Are you Mr. Eaves?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm Bob Edwards. I'm the current director of the Museum of Victoria." And I said, "Have you come to pursue me and throw me out again?" And he said, "No, I need a curator, an honorary curator." I didn't realize that I was being conned into working for no money at all. And I said, "Will I get a car space?" And Bob said, "Yes, because I don't drive." The story goes on, because not only did I then get conned into going to borrow stuff from the Netherlands for an exhibition he had planned, but he also converted me to Aboriginal art. And I'll always be very grateful for that, because it changed my life dramatically. And thank you, Bob.
Janie. I would like to know more about the Edwards report from the 1970s that you found so extraordinary, Philip. Perhaps it's a question to be addressed to any of the panel, but to you or even Bob.
Janie Anderson, thanks very much for the question. Well, the Edwards report is an extraordinary document, because cultural institutions in colonial cities in Australia had more or less run under their own steam for a very long time on a shoestring, and some still do, I think. And in Adelaide, the South Australian Museum had certainly literally run on a shoestring, and people had become used to getting by.
And the collections that had come in, particularly Aboriginal collections from the hinterland of South Australia's northern colony, which was the Northern Territory, during the key period of colonialism from the 1860s to 1911, this material had come in collection by collection, often very well documented. But, of course, the facility and the capability of the museum to manage this material once it arrived was very, very limited. And ultimately, as John Mulvaney pointed out, we did end up with storage in the attic, literally in the attic. And there was an issue there for not only for the museum but for the visitors, and it was becoming... It had actually reached the point where literally you did have to bring a torch into the museum to see the exhibits. I think there was even one salutary article suggesting that it'd be better if you didn't light a match. But nevertheless, that was the situation that it was in. And really, from people working within the museum, the dilemma was... How do you shift this? How do you... I mean, do you wait until the place literally moulders away? I remember there was a cat. You remember the cat, Bob, that used to live in the foreign ethnology store out in the armoury, and it got into the store through a hole in the wall, which was to the outer, environment, and went in for shelter at night, a little bit like the cats that lived in the... in the breakwater at West Beach. The issue is how do you get that message across? And being from that sort of culture where you essentially ride with the punches and go with the flow, as the museum had done for well over a century, it is really difficult to move into a different paradigm where you are essentially either shaming the institution or the government that runs the museum, or convincing them with this legendary charm. And the museum hadn't experienced that before. But luckily, I think, we did have, through this period in the 1970s, the Dunstan years, we did have a more enlightened breed of politician coming through, and this was absolutely critical. There were people like Murray Hill, for example, and certainly Dunstan himself, Lena Mardio, who became the supremo of the arts for nearly a decade in South Australia. So I don't know the exact circumstances, and this hasn't been written up, and it's probably going to be elicited from Bob at some stage. But certainly... It became apparent that something had to be done with the museum, but there were a whole range of other problems as well, so that the Edwards Report became not just a report into how to get the museum up and running properly, but the idea that there could be an articulated solution to a whole range of issues which we now take for granted as being integrated, such as conservation, the role of a history museum vis-a-vis a natural history museum, the interrelationships within a museum that had come out of the British model, which was essentially a natural history museum with an ethnographic component. And in a way, the British Museum and the Museum of Mankind had to deal with these similar issues. So... I think Bob's involvement, particularly with UNESCO and his trip to Europe in 1971, which must have been a remarkable experience, where he was exposed not only to best practice of managing museums and cultural sites, but also to the sort of people that could get these things happening. And the lines of logic that you could use, I think, in terms of dealing with politicians... this all is brought to bear in the Edwards Report. It's just a very nicely, clearly written, jargon-free document that explains in plain English why it is that a set of cultural treasures of the stature of the ones that we had in South Australia needed better attention. And the remarkable thing is that it was It was welcomed and initially accepted by both sides of politics as being a self-evident truth once it was revealed. The only problem is we had this massive train wreck about to happen, which was the collapse of our state bank. And unfortunately, we got through the first few phases. We built the Science Centre. The State Conservation Centre was built. And we had this articulation of the institutions beginning to happen on North Terrace, and it was nipped in the bud. But I believe there is at least one politician in this room who was heavily involved in the proceedings, John Bannon, and we'll be hearing from him later on this. Yes. Alan.
Thank you. On the Edwards Report, my first job in the cultural world was as a research assistant to Bob on the Edwards Report back in 1980 when he was first starting up Cultural Collections Council. And all of you in the room who are friends of Bob know that friendship with Bob revolves around a lot of fine food and even finer wine. And I had several chapters I had responsibility for in the Edwards Report, but the one that Bob took the most personal interest in was the one on the restaurants.
Was Alan Smith, Director of the State Library of South Australia. Time for one or two more, maybe.
And just one final point on the Edwards Report, because it's still remarkably current. We were asked for a copy of it from our Minister's office just last December, and we sent through, for those of you from South Australia who know the Edwards Report, it is many volumes thick, and each volume is roughly the size of a telephone directory. And we sent through what we call the Blue Report to the Premier's office. And I got a phone call saying, oh, sorry, perhaps we didn't make ourselves clear. We just want the executive summary. And I said, no, that is the executive summary. What I would like to say is that it is an incredibly current report still, although it was done many years ago and was specific to the South Australian circumstances. It very much encompasses the ethos of what museums should and could be in a very modern world, and particularly moving forward. So it's an extraordinarily futuristic document even now.
Thank you, Suzanne. Well, we have reached lunchtime, so could be a good opportunity to move into lunch.
Yes, indeed. But before I deliver my announcements, can I ask you all to thank the gentleman to my left? Well, it is lunchtime, but before we break, I have one pleasant duty, and that is that today, of course, is a day for recognition and acknowledgement. And what I'd like to do is to bring to your attention someone who's been very closely connected with Bob at the National Museum for many years. One of the great treasures of the National Museum's collection is the Bob Edwards collection. And that collection, which comprises books and papers and all sorts of material that reflects Bob's interests and also his contributions to the world, as we're hearing today. But that collection's been created through a very warm and long-standing relationship between Bob and the museum's librarian, Julie Phillips. Now, yesterday, Julie retired after working here for 23 years. She's sitting in the middle of the hall there, and I'd like to ask you to acknowledge and congratulate her, acknowledge the work that she's done for the museum and for Bob over many years. Thanks, Julie. And if you don't know Julie, she's the one who's embarrassed at the moment. So. Now, that's the morning session, and I have to say, this tribute is shaping up exactly as Philip envisaged it and as we all hoped it would go. Thank you all for your contributions so far. We'll go to lunch in the hall, and we will be back promptly for 2 p.m. Thanks.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.